Federal Drive is presented by GEHA, Government Employees Health Association, proudly providing health and dental benefits to federal employees and their families. Visit GEHA.com.
Stocks and bonds both have gyrated badly in recent weeks. It's not a fun time to be invested, and yet you sort of have to be. For an assessment of the recent few weeks, we turn to certified financial planner Art Stein of Arthur Stein Financial. All right, give us the review, Art. It's been a stomach-churning kind of gyroscope.
So the C and the S and the I funds, in the first quarter of this year up through March 31st, they had done great. The C fund was up 10.5%, S was up 7%, and the I fund 6%. So that was a really good 3 months. But then through last Friday, the end of last week, all of a sudden things completely turned around. And during that 3 week period, all three of those stock funds were down considerably. C fund down 5%, S fund down 6.9%, I fund down 4%. So all of a sudden year to date, C fund's still up, the S fund is down, I fund's pretty flat. So it just completely turned around. Now, the bond funds, again, during the first quarter, the F fund was down about 0.7%, but now year to date, it's down 3%. And the reason for this, in my opinion, is that the Federal Reserve has a very ambitious goal to reduce inflation in the United States to 2%. It looked like inflation was going down pretty much monthly. I'm not saying prices were going down, but the rate of inflation was decreasing each month. And as a result, people expected there would be about 3 interest rate reductions by the Fed during this year. Well, that decline in the inflation rate has stalled. And now commentators say, well, we may not get any interest rate reductions this year. And partly as a result of this, interest rates have increased. The 10-year bond, the interest rate went from 4.2% to 4.6%. That's a big change in the interest rate on the 10-year bonds. It's a very high rate. Of course, mortgage rates are over 7% again. And things just look very different in terms of the financial markets. Now, in terms of the economy continues to do extremely well. Employment is very strong. The economy's strong. We're not really seeing problems there. But of course, the stock market and the bond markets, they, you know, are affected by the economy, but they're affected by a lot of other things too.
Well, sure. So, if you have high interest rates, though, that can depress housing, although some parts of the country housing is going gangbusters, other parts of the country not so much. New housing starts, those affect the economy at some point because housing, like automobiles, are drivers of lots of other related commodity sales.
But, you know, the mortgage rate, the rate for new mortgages really has not changed that much. I mean, it's over 7% now. It's been over 7%, you know, it was last year at various times. Went down maybe a little under 7%. We're not seeing big changes. And one thing that I would point out is that the inflation rate, which is the change from the previous year in prices, last month was 3.5%. You know, people are saying, well, that's so high. But actually, the average annual inflation rate in the United States since 1950 has been 3.5%. It's exactly the same rate. The inflation rate we have now is just average compared to the historical rate in the United States. And I don't know why the Fed wants to get it down to 2%, thinks it can get it down to 2%. We have had inflation that low, but that was so unusual. And with these huge budget deficits that we're running, huge budget deficits, and this big increase in the amount of money the federal government owes and has to finance every year, it makes it very hard to get inflation down.
Right. I think that might be a dawning factor in some of these markets. For example, the interest on the public debt by the federal government, that outlay now exceeds the defense budget. And so,
yeah,
you know, yeah. And when you look at it in terms of the percentage of GDP that is represented by debt and all of these things, those numbers are beginning to become visibly and unassailably unsustainable. And you've got people in the government saying that as well.
So for individual investors, which is, you know, your listeners, I would say one thing I really would like to emphasize is that if you're worried about inflation, keep in mind that historically stocks, which we mean the C and the S and the I fund, have historically been a very good hedge against inflation because they tend to go up in price along with inflation. Their sales tend to go up with inflation. Their dividends tend to go up with inflation. Now, bonds are not a good hedge against inflation. And both the G and the F fund, whether it's low inflation or high inflation, people should expect that after you take into account taxes and inflation, the rate of return on the bond funds is probably going to be negative, i.e., your purchasing power is going to go down, even though the value of the bond fund might go up. But it will not go up enough to compensate for taxes and inflation. So we're really back where we've been, well, forever. Past performance is no guarantee of future performance, but historically, stocks have considerably outperformed bonds over longer periods of time, and they've done it by enough to increase purchasing power after taking into account taxes and inflation.
In some funny sense, bonds are like money because they are based on loans, ultimately, whereas stocks are based on different types of securities. So it's kind of like the old rule, your money may go down in value, but if you can have your holdings rise in value with the degree your money's going down, like you've been describing, you're going to be in better shape.
Exactly. So, you know, if you wanted to look at the 15-year average rates of return, I mean, the C fund has averaged 14.5% per year for 15 years. The G fund only 2.4%. The F fund only 2.6%. That's a big difference.
Right. So whatever instrument you're in, you want to stay at least ahead of inflation to be able to tread water.
Yeah. I mean, if you're trying to finance your retirement with investments that are going to lose purchasing power over time, that makes it very difficult to do. And of course, FERS retirees, anytime inflation's over 2%, the adjustment in their FERS retirement is less than the full inflation rate. The purchasing power of their FERS annuity is going to go down over time. So if they're all in the F and G fund, then that purchasing power is going down over time. I mean, that's a problem.
All right. So then, like you say, the eternal advice is try to stay in the historically high growth funds and don't lose your nerve because they're gyrating now.
Exactly. I'm not saying don't have investments in the F and G fund. I think those are very worthwhile, but you need to have a solid percentage in the CS and I funds.
Art Stein is a certified financial planner of Arthur Stein Financial. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts.
Leadership today, especially within the federal workforce, is being tested more than ever before. As the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency's Chief People Officer, Elizabeth Comstetter sees a focus on people as absolutely crucial to her leadership style. Comstetter joined Shane Canfield, WEPA CEO, to reflect on her years of experience leading in the federal human capital space.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today I'm joined by Dr. Elizabeth Comstetter, Chief People Officer at the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
In your current position at CISA, one of your responsibilities is ensuring a people-first culture. Explain what that is, and what's the role of leadership in creating and shaping that culture?
Yes, at CISA, really paramount to our culture is a people-first driven aspect, so that we are really looking at how do we accomplish our mission through our people. And in order to do that, we really value our people. We want them to feel empowered and supported and respected. And also that their managers care about them. So well-being is important. Psychological safety in the workplace is important so that all voices and ideas are heard. So I like to call it our North Star. Having a people-first culture really starts with the people in order to get our incredibly difficult mission accomplished. In terms of leadership, which is a great question, I think we all know that culture is really driven by leadership and the behaviors that we allow and we reinforce in our leaders. So we really work at making sure that our leaders are bringing out the best in their people every day. So again, that they feel they can bring their voice, especially an opinion that might not go along with the majority of a group, so that we get that diverse perspective, we get those different ideas and experiences. And that's really where we find that it's important that leaders are purposefully bringing out their talent on their teams to enable our mission.
Excellent. We're going through a culture project at our work.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's been 6 months in the making, and it's going really well, but it is work.
Yes.
And it requires from the top down, so I'm also involved in that. I hear you.
Great.
Throughout your career, you've piloted many different talent management programs, including at NASA, the CIA, the FBI, just to name a few, and you have an amazing career. What have you learned or how have you might have changed along the way in creating and leading those programs?
Yes, and I am so honored to have had a career in public service across multiple federal agencies, always in the realm of human resources and workforce performance. And I think because I study organizations and people in them, I've come to realize, particularly in the federal government, that many of our programs are really grounded in the industrial era thinking, that this is organizationally structured in a hierarchy with boxes and lines on charts, with the center being around jobs and what do we need to get this job done in terms of skills and training. And what I found is that we're really not in the industrial era anymore, where we would promote the smartest people who knew that work, and they would then tell the people on their team how to do things and oversee that work. We're now in a digital era and the information era, where work gets done collaboratively across geographic boundaries and certainly across org charts. So we like to call it networks or hierarchies, and we really need to, again, unleash people so they can find those other people who are working on similar problems or have the right ideas. And so I really like to think of our work now in the talent programs being human-centered. It's more about the user and the experience than about the rules and regulations. So although we have to have rules and regulations, certainly in human resources, is that person experiencing what they need and getting what they need for their role at that time? So not so much on the job, but on the person. So for example, we're recruiting. What's the applicant experiencing? Because if they're not having a good experience with our organization from the time we're recruiting them, they're going to go work for somebody else. Same thing with like first-time supervisors. We know they need certain training, but telling them to sit in a class for 1 week and then hope a year from now they'll remember what they learned to apply, that's not really human-centered. The human-centered is what do they need when they need it, and building modules or just-in-time training and bringing that to the people, to that user, as they need it. So that's really, I think, the most important focus of talent programs today in this era to enable the workers to be the best they can be in their roles.
Excellent. New thinking. This is always an interesting question. Has there been a time when, as a leader, that you've made a mistake? And what is that? And I think most important, what did you take away from that? What did you learn from that?
Well, I kind of chuckle because I think as leaders, we have to learn to recognize our mistakes, admit our mistakes, and that they are opportunities to learn. And so I've had to do my own self-reflection on making mistakes and when things don't turn out the way that I expected them to. Makes me think of a time when I was at the Transportation Security Administration and I was a supervisor. And I was really embroiled with my program. I was the technical leader of it. I understood it. I'd run it for years. And I was making a briefing for a decision that had to be made about this program that was very near and dear to me. And I presented the briefing to one of the very senior people in the agency. And I think there are about 20 people in the room. And I had gone through the briefing, answered all the questions. And that leader then said, okay, I'm going to go around the room and get everybody's opinion, and then everybody gets to vote, which kind of set me aback because there were people in that room that didn't have any technical knowledge about my program. She even turned to the executive assistant there, taking notes on the meeting, and said, go ahead, and I want to hear from you. And I realized, in hindsight, I had stopped listening. I had been in transmitting all of my knowledge and what I saw to be the right way, and I was not listening to different perspectives in the room because I didn't think that, I didn't value that they were bringing any kind of input to this particular decision. And it didn't go as I had hoped. And I left very disappointed and was busy blaming the senior leader and how that meeting was conducted, that she let all these people have opinions when they didn't know, in my mind, didn't know what they were talking about. And so in reflection on that, I realize, and now as I've moved into more senior leadership positions, I realize that was a mistake, that it actually is really important to listen, especially to people who have different perspectives or at a different point in the career, not just the people who know the program or the technical really well. And so that was a mistake I made, and I realized in my own sense I wasn't listening to very different opinions, and I probably should have because I would have learned more about what was needed for this program going forward than just leaving, getting upset that it didn't go a certain way. So I've really practiced active listening. I've practiced making sure there's very different people on teams and certainly on committees or councils, that we need early careers, people new to the agency, people who haven't walked in the shoes of the technical workforce, because they're asking questions we need to hear for these programs to be successful.
Excellent. Your career in talent management means your work is very closely tied to people. And even your title, Chief People Officer, what does that mean to you to be a leader in the federal system with that focus?
Isn't that a great title? I just love the title Chief People Officer, and I think it's my dream job, really, to be focused on people and culture and the workforce strategy for the whole agency. And I'm just so excited to be at CISA at this point in time. We're only 4 years young as an agency, so we're really still creating who we're going to become as an agency and what is our culture and what kind of people and talent do we need to be sure we have to be successful. So it's very exciting for me to be in this role with a intentional focus on culture. Because it's one of those things, if you leave it to chance and you kind of hope it goes the way you want it to, it probably won't. So by building programs, including leadership development programs, including any kind of training and learning and career growth and engagement programs and listening programs, that's what's really key for, I think, for our agency and particularly me in this role. I think in the federal government, we got used to doing annual survey, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey that OPM, Office of Personnel Management, runs every year. So we would do a survey and we'd read it and we'd say, oh, this is the opinion of our people. And then we would do action plans and then we'd roll out certain activities that we would hope would increase engagement. In this era, you can't do once a year and understand what your employees' experiences are, what they need, what's working well, and what needs to improve. We need active, ongoing listening programs. So one of the things we're doing at CISA is having more pulse surveys, having more focus groups and what we call sensing sessions, expecting our leaders to have office hours where anybody can come and just talk about what's going well, what do they need, how are things going? Because we feel like it is an ongoing need to hear from our people. And I think in this role and over the years of serving, I've also realized there's never a one-size-fits-all. You know, we think certain people need certain things at certain times in their career. There's no one-size-fits-all. Neither can we also customize everything to every individual. So there's got to be a sweet spot in building really great talent programs, but also, like I said, thinking about, can we do this in modules? Can we make it a menu? Can we do it just in time as people need it so they can practice the new skill or knowledge in their role? So I think we have such great opportunity, again, with the technology that enables us to really focus on how we connect people with their work and their team to get things done in very new ways.
This is always an interesting question. Is there a figure, either from your personal life, your past, somewhere in history generally, that inspired you, your leadership style, how you view leadership?
There are many figures who have been very inspirational to me, but there is one that sticks out, and that's my mother, Paula Brownlee, who has been a very inspiring leader to me all my life. And I think because, first and foremost, she had a strong family and a strong career. And that's something I always wanted. And I saw her first as my mother, but then I also saw her as a leader in her career and in academia, which was her chosen field. But I always knew her family came first. And as I saw how she balanced different family needs with also a growing and more prominent career positions in leadership, that she had to balance that. And I think I learned from her that you can have both. You have to focus on different things through your career and through your life, but that you don't have to trade one for the other. I've been married, happily married, for 32 years, and I'm a mother of twins who are almost 24 years old. So, and I've had a great career in public service. So I think that having her as a role model has really helped me find my own courage, find my own confidence, and find my own voice in how I can prioritize the things that are most important to me so that I can actually balance both family and career.
And you're doing it well. Thank you. Having known you now for 7 or 8 years, and work alongside you, your passion is infectious.
Thank you.
Your intelligence and the thoughtfulness with which you approach all of these issues, it's an honor for you to be here, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Shane Canfield, CEO at WEPA, and until next time, have a great day.
Find the full podcast and future episodes of Lessons in Leadership on the Federal News Network app and anywhere you enjoy your podcasts.